Hello and welcome to the Bumpsy Proceedings Podcast. Every 2 months, we discuss an article or a related subject from the current edition of the Baylor University Medical Center, Proceedings, the peer-reviewed journal of Baylor Scott & White Health. The editor of Proceedings is Dr. James W. Fleshman, who is Chief of Surgery at Baylor University Medical Center and Professor of Surgery at Texas A&M College of Medicine, Dallas. The Proceedings podcast is also sponsored by Dr. Harry T. Papaconstantino, who holds the Glenn E. and Rita K. Roney Endowed Chair in Surgery and is Professor and Chair of the Department of Surgery at Baylor Scott & White Medical Center in Temple, Texas. The featured article for the January 2025 edition of Proceedings is Effect of a Lower Dose of Intrathecal Morphine on Postoperative Opioid Consumption Following Cesarean Delivery at a Texas Level 4 Maternal Care Center. My guest today, Michael Hofkamp, MD, is the corresponding author for the article. Information about the article can be found in the show notes. Dr. Hofkamp attended medical school at Rosalind Franklin University of Medicine and Science, followed by an internship in internal medicine at Lutheran General Hospital in Park Ridge, Illinois. He completed his residency in anesthesiology at the Johns Hopkins Hospital. Dr. Hofkamp has worked at Baylor Scott & White for 15 years and has been the Director of Obstetric Anesthesia at Baylor Scott & White Medical Center, Temple, for 12 years. He serves as a contributing editor for Obstetric Anesthesia Digest and is on the editorial advisory board of the Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology Canada. He also serves on the Baylor Scott & White Research Institute Institutional Review Board. Dr. Hofkamp, thanks for being here today to talk about your article.
Thank you for having me.
Please give me an overview of how postoperative cesarean delivery pain is treated.
Well, typically we use a multimodal approach involving non-opioid analgesics such as acetaminophen and ketorolac. When we are doing spinal anesthesia for patients, we will administer intrathecal morphine, which provides really good postoperative analgesia.
Tell us what intrathecal means.
That's a great question. Intrathecal means that we are injecting the medicine into the cerebral spinal fluid.
How does that compare to epidural?
Great question again. Epidural administration is administration into the epidural space. The epidural space surrounds a structure called the dura. Medication from the epidural space has to make a long journey from the epidural space through the dura and then into the cerebral spinal fluid. When we do intrathecal injection, we bypass that structure of the dura and inject medicine directly where it needs to go.
Mm-hmm. Tell me more about intrathecal morphine and the doses used.
That's another great question. So the doses of intrathecal morphine range from as low as 75 micrograms to as high as 200 micrograms or greater. It's kind of a magic trick to get the best analgesic dose with the minimization of side effects.
Why did you decide to decrease the dose of intrathecal morphine used at your hospital?
I became the director of obstetric anesthesia at my hospital in 2013, and we were then using 200 micrograms of intrathecal morphine, which at that time was in line with the mainstream practice. Over the ensuing decade, investigators started to report efficacy and decreased side effects using lower doses of intrathecal morphine. And so in 2023, we decreased our dose from 200 micrograms to 150 micrograms to decrease side effects. Another important consideration was monitoring for postoperative respiratory depression. SOAP and the ASA and ASRA came out with a joint statement that stated that we could do decreased monitoring for patients if they got a decreased dose of intrathecal morphine. One of the dangers of intrathecal morphine is that patients can get respiratory depression where they kind of forget to breathe, if you want to call it that. Mm. And this peaks bimodally, first at 2 hours from systemic absorption, and then at 12 hours from migration in the cerebral spinal fluid up to the medullary centers of the brainstem. And so it's very important for this medication to be safe. And so what the standard recommendation is, if you're doing 200 micrograms, we would have to monitor patients every hour, their respiratory rate and their pulse oximetry, for the first 12 hours. Mm-hmm. For the second 12 hours, we would do it every 2 hours. As you can imagine, this is quite onerous for the patients and for the nurses. And so by decreasing the dose to 150 micrograms, lower risk patients can have less intensive monitoring. And so instead of what I just described, the patients who meet the criteria and have 150 micrograms or less of intrathecal morphine will only get respiratory rate and pulse oximetry monitored every 2 hours for the first 12 hours. And there's no monitoring for that domain after that.
Mm-hmm. How frequently does intrathecal morphine cause respiratory depression?
It's actually exceedingly low. It's far less than 1%. In my own personal clinical practice, I've actually never seen it. And so it remains a theoretical concern. The Food and Drug Administration approved this medication with a black box warning that you have to monitor patients for 24 hours. So patients who receive intrathecal morphine cannot be discharged from the hospital for 24 hours.
Mm-hmm. How did you conduct your study?
So what we did is we did a practice change where we changed our dose, and then we did an observational study where we looked at patients who met inclusion criteria, and we used data from the electronic medical record that was entered into a data collection tool by a study investigator, and then we did statistical analysis to see if there was a difference or not.
What challenges did you have in completing your study?
Well, I think one of the biggest challenges is the tedious collection of the data. Right now, we live in a unique time where we have an abundance of data in our electronic medical records that are completely useless to us in their current form. And so someone has to extract that information from the medical record into a platform that's usable for us investigators. We use REDCap, which is hosted by the Baylor Scott & White Research Institute. And right now, there's a unique opportunity for ambitious medical students and or residents to take on lead roles in these kinds of projects where they can spend 50 to 100 hours on a project collecting data, and we can come to some meaningful conclusions often, and it provides some benefit for our patient care. In the future, what I think is that artificial intelligence tools will go in like bots and retrieve that data, and then this practice will be validated. And so instead of a medical student or a resident spending 50 to 100 hours on a project, a bot may take a couple minutes to do all that work. We're not quite there yet, and I think it's going to be at least 5 to 10 years before we get there. But for now, we're kind of in this halfway zone where we've got all this data, but it's not easily extracted. And it's an exciting time to be in medicine, in my opinion.
Is it fair to ask, were you pleased with the results of this study?
I was pleased. The hypothesis was that the patients who received a lower dose of intrathecal morphine would have a higher amount of opioid consumption. And the fact that they did not did please me. One of the limitations of this study, which I addressed in the manuscript, was that we use a convenience sample. And so we looked at 1 year of data versus another year of data. And one of the limitations of using that method is that it's sometimes difficult to interpret a result where there's no difference. And so when you look at our results, the median amount of opioid consumption in the first 24 hours was 10 milligrams for both cohorts. That was not statistically significant in difference. And so I can reasonably conclude that lowering the dose of intrathecal morphine did not lead to increased opioid consumption.
So these results are in line with the goal of reducing opioid consumption. Is that correct?
Yes. So there's a couple good news applications of this, of our findings. One, we're using opioid consumption as a surrogate marker for pain. That being, people who use less opioids can be reasonably assumed to have had less pain. And two, the opioid epidemic is such that we want to decrease the amount of opioids used by patients in and out of the hospital. And that goal is accomplished not only with our intrathecal morphine, but with our non-opioid analgesics, such as acetaminophen that we give orally and the ketorolac that we give intravenously for the first 24 hours, and we'll give ibuprofen after that.
What practice changes do you hope will happen because of your study at your hospital?
What I hope is that lower risk patients can have less intensive monitoring where we can optimize the patient experience. They're not getting bothered every hour during the first 12 hours of delivery. And we are still maintaining patient safety. And physicians at my hospital are already empowered to modify the existing order set, but we would hope to codify this a little bit more and make it available to more patients.
Where do you see the future of intrathecal morphine in cesarean delivery or other surgical procedures?
So that's another great question. I think that intrathecal morphine for cesarean delivery is here to stay. Concurrently, we have gone to our gynecologic oncologic colleagues who do these open procedures where they're not minimally invasive. They make big midline laparotomies, and they have been using intrathecal morphine in the same dose of 150 micrograms, and they have been getting some pretty astonishing results with decreased opioid consumption following surgery, and also decreased length of stay. And so we're planning on studying the effect of intrathecal morphine in these patients in a study yet to come.
Dr. Hofkamp, thanks so much for talking with us about your study. I wish you the best in your work as the Director of Obstetric Anesthesia at Baylor Scott & White Medical Center, Temple.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure to talk to you about my study and to inform your audience.
That concludes this episode. Be on the lookout for the next podcast episode from Bumpsy Proceedings, scheduled to be published in March 2025.